Hello and welcome to Rippercast, your podcast on Jack the Ripper and the Whitechapel murders. As we look forward to this year's East End Conference taking place 2 weeks from today, on the 11th and 12th of October, in the heart of the East End, we're bringing you 6 talks from the East End Conference of 2024. And next up is Stephen Keough with What Was Jack the Ripper's Motive?
Hello.
They're very, very nice.
I've been there for extra capacity, and I can be taking them home later.
Open mouth in certain places.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Mr. Copper.
Not working. Hello. Hey! It's the only report I've ever received. Thank you, organisers.
Yes,
thank you, everybody. Welcome back to the East End Conference 2024. Your hosts, myself, Adam, Andrew, Abby, and Mark, all are well rested. We take this very seriously. Quick trip to the gym last night. And we know that you're all fully refreshed after last night. I'm told I'm not allowed to name names, but somebody was so affected by that curry last night that they cried in it. Thanks for telling me for that, Susie. Sorry, Rick. Welcome back again. Day two. I'm sorry, Kyle, there's not so many freebies today. You have to buy books today rather than have things given to you. One thing we didn't pull complete yesterday was the charity Beyond the Streets. I said I'd look to see what they did, and basically it's a charity for, this is their term, for people who sell sex, and it's for people who've been the victims of abuse and coercion. And we raised £132 for that yesterday. Can you give yourself a round of applause? That's a working charity. That's a massive difference. I have one very, very informal question to ask you. Does anyone here watch Peep Show?
Yes.
God, this is going to go well. So there's a scene in Peep Show where he's a ripper guide for like half an episode, and he's standing on what I thought was Puma Court. If you know where he's standing, can you let me know? I'm just trying to take a photo of then and now type of thing. If you do know the answer to that, do let me know. So before we start, I'd like to thank Toby for wearing a band t-shirt for a band from the 80s. That's what we're doing here today. Excellent. I'd like to congratulate Kieran on rivaling Mark's shirt. That's nice too. One thing we have to do today is, if you would like you to fill in a feedback form at the end of the show, that'd be very, very handy. It just helps us work on next year's show so we know exactly what we're trying to do, what we need to improve. All feedback is very, very welcome. We have 2 talks and a conversation today. Really looking forward to the conversation. Not the slightest bit nervous. Wow. Go easy on me, Paul, please. Absolutely.
There's so many questions I have to ask.
You. The very first time I appeared on Rippercast, they told me after that you were coming on, and the first thing you accused me of being the most hated ripperologist in the history of the field.
Has anything changed?
Absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. Our first speaker today is Steve or Stephen?
Steve
is Steve Keogh, who's just come up to me and said that he subscribes to the Anfield Rant that I write for. Thanks very much. He's heard of me. He's going to be giving a talk on about your book about being a police inspector and just looking back at the Jack and the Ripper murders and see what would be done differently.
Not quite.
No. You showed me here yesterday when I got Tarbridge and Tarrell London and stuff. I do apologise for that, but please welcome very easy to feel, Steve.
Yeah, so this is what I'm going to be talking about. So I'm going to be writing about looking at what may have been motivating him, and we'll get there in a bit. But first off, I just wanted to talk a little bit about me, so you know who I am. So my name's Steve Keogh. I joined the police in 1991, and I did 30 years in Macron Police. And very early on, what I realised that I really enjoyed was going after bad guys. Now, I know it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but catching criminals was what really got me going, and it was what I got up for in the morning. And that kind of dragged me down a route to become a detective. And I was posted to South London, Greenwich in South London, which is where I grew up. And I grew up on a dodgy council estate. So I policed the area I went to school in, so that wasn't difficult at all. But then I became a detective, and I went to Peckham in South East London. And then I went on to the anti-terrorist branch in about 2002. And I stayed there for a few years. And I left just after the 7/7 bombs, so we're not very far away from at least one of those. And I dealt with Edgware Road, so I was first on scene there from the anti-terrorist branch, stayed there for 2 weeks and dealt with that bomb scene there. Then I became a detective sergeant and I got moved to Tower Hamlets, so Whitechapel, the area we are. Actually, are we there? I think we might be City, or I don't know, we're right in the border there anyway. So anyway, Tower Hamlets in the East End. So I spent about 3 years there dealing with robberies and rapes. So I really got to know the area and I got to know the seedier side of it, because when you're dealing with those crimes, you have to get down and dirty with the people that are committing them, dealing with the victims, etc. So I saw a side of Whitechapel that a lot of people probably wouldn't see just from walking and driving around. And then in 2009, that always sounds like a bit cliche when I say this, but I found my calling in life. I went as a detective sergeant onto the murder teams. I worked in Lewisham in South London. And honestly, when I got there, and it was the first conviction I had at court. When I've been through the journey with the family, and murder investigations are hard on everybody involved, none more so than the families, obviously. They've lost someone in the most tragic circumstances, and then they have to embark on what is not set up for victims and the families, etc., our criminal justice system. And eventually you get through and you get that conviction. And that first conviction call for me was that was it. I can't do anything else. So I stayed doing murder for the rest of my career. I got promoted to detective inspector there, investigated over 100. I couldn't put a figure on it, but in some capacity or other, I was involved in over 100 murder investigations. And for me, it was the best job in the world. And so since I've left the police, what I talk about is murder. It's like, I should let it go, but it's what I know and it's what I enjoy. And it's what I know most about. And because of that, when I left the police, I didn't want to work for anybody. I wanted to try and have my own business doing something or other. But I investigate murders. What else can I do with that? So I've tried different things. One of those, I dabbled in YouTube, and I don't do it anymore. But I had a lot of American American subscribers. And they kept asking me about Jack Ripper. I've got to be honest, I know nothing about Jack Ripper. Now, I'm ashamed to say, I knew that he killed some people in the East End, I knew that they were sex workers, numbers, the people, the crimes, etc. I didn't know. So I thought, I better look into this, so I started to do some research into it. And when I did that, something really, really jumped out at me that really piqued my interest, and that was Frederick Abelin. What I've just described, my career journey, very much mirrored his own. So I worked in terrorism, I dealt with mostly Islamic. He dealt with Fenians. From there, I went to this area of London. He did the same. And from there, I went to Scotland Yard investigating murders. And it was that really got my mind racing. I was like, well, how would I deal with what Frederick Abelin had to face? And how would it change? What would I do different? And it was that that really sort of piqued my interest. And it was around that time, I've written my first book, and my publishers were like, have you got anything for a second book? And I thought, well, actually, I really quite like the Jack the Ripper case and how I've come into it. I'd like to look at that. So I said, okay, well, what angle are you going to come at? I'm not here. I did not want to be the person who tried to solve Jack the Ripper. That was not why I wrote the book. It was about, well, what did Abilene do back then? How would it differ to today? How would I approach those murders if I was confronted with them today? So that's how I approached the book. And there were three questions I really wanted to... No, actually, there were two I wanted to look at and one I had to look at. The two I wanted to look at was, what crimes did he commit and why did he commit them? And if I'm writing a book about Jack the Ripper, I had to look at who he was. And I've got to be brutally honest, that was the least of the questions that I had really an interest in, because I wanted to understand the crimes and what was motivating him. And then when I started to look at the evidence, I was even more sure of that, because let's be honest, there's a few descriptions. And I'll get this out of there now. I, as far as I'm concerned, we do not know who Jack the Ripper is, and I don't want to upset anybody in this room, because I know you're all passionate about it. But for me, looking at it as a detective, there was so little evidence that I had to address it, but that wasn't what really interested me. It was the what and the why. And that's what I started to look at, and that's what I really started to enjoy. Now, when I wrote my first book, I went to some Facebook groups, and I said, I'm a detective inspector, I've written a book about murder, what would you like to know about? And the number one question, beyond any shadow of a doubt, was, why do people kill? And it's that I started to put my mind to. And it's that I'm going to talk about today and then apply it to the crimes that are attributed to Jack the Ripper. So why do people kill? Now, on the face of it, it's a complicated question. And when I started to address it, I was like, I can't see any, there's no pattern to it. I was trying to understand from the murders I investigated, looking at other murders that other people investigated, is there any kind of pattern? And I've got to be honest, I couldn't see any. If there was one, it was beyond me. I need to think about this differently. So then I started to think about, why do people do anything? Why do people do anything in life? And I'm coming at it that way. And when I did that, it was like a light bulb moment. Because as human beings, we only do things, we only choose to do things because of one of three reasons. And that is because of how we feel, how we want to feel, and the benefit we're going to get from that action that we choose to do. And when you do that, when you look at it in terms of what motivates somebody for anything, you can then apply that to murder and it works directly. So this, if we just think about why we do anything, why does Cole go to the gym? why do we go to the gym?
I was nice to you.
Why do we go to the gym? Well, we go to the gym because of how we feel, how we want to feel, the benefit we get. How do we feel? So I feel lethargic. I feel overweight. I can feel inspired. You know, you can't get on a tennis court and Wimbledon's around, can you? Because I'm inspired by what I see. So I'm going to go to the gym because I'm feeling like this. Or I'm going to go to the gym because I know that when I go there, I'm going to feel something. I'm going to get that rush of endorphins. I'm going to get that buzz from beating my personal best. Or I'm just going to feel better about myself. And I know by going to the gym afterwards, I'm going to feel something that I enjoy. Or the benefit I get. So I'm going to go there, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to have that beach body. I'm going to be able to sleep better at night, whatever it is. But whatever we break it down, it will come to one of those things. And I've not come up with this and think, well, Steve, you're a genius. You've worked humans out. I haven't. This is obvious. And so, for instance, people that want your money, they know that too. If we look at this advert here for a charity, this is designed to peak one of those three things: how you feel. I'm looking at this. How do I feel? I feel guilty. Like they're going to put on a young child. Big eyes, who looks cute, who's going to make you feel something. He's going to make you feel sorry for them, going to make you feel guilty about yourself. Or how do I want to feel? I don't know, if I give money here, I'm going to feel so much better about myself. I'm going to feel like I've done something. Or the benefit. So the benefit doesn't have to be for you, it could be for somebody else. So by me giving money, this young child here is going to have a better life. So whatever we choose to do in life, we do it because of one of those three things. How we feel, how we want to feel, and the benefit we're going to get. But how does that relate to why people kill? Is it a direct comparison? Well, yes, it is. If you take away the legal ramifications, the moral ramifications, by someone choosing to kill somebody, it's still an act they're choosing to do, and they will do so because of one of those three reasons. I'm going to do it back to front, so I want to end up on one particular one. but for the benefit. So when we're talking about murders that are relating to robbery, a hitman, gangs, drug dealers, when they mete out violence and they hurt somebody, they're doing it because there's a benefit to them. They will get money. They will get a larger slice of the drug trade. They will. Terrorism comes into this as well. When they hurt people, they're doing it because they believe it will benefit their cause. It will further their cause. So when we think of all those murders and the mechanics around it, it's simple. It's a dog, isn't it? I thought it was a person.
No, no.
I'm getting worried. When we think of the mechanics around it, what is going on? I want this thing. I want this benefit, and I'm going to hurt you to get it. And I call that gain. That to me is gain. So it's where a person kills for a beneficial gain to them or others. I want something to get it. I have to hurt you. I have to kill you. That's gain. How we feel. So when we're talking about crimes that are committed because of jealousy, anger, disrespect, I need to get revenge, those feelings that you feel that drive you on to commit this crime, I call that the push of emotion. It's where someone kills as a result of a triggered emotion. If we just think about the mechanics of what's happening in these crimes, something happens that triggers an immense, intense emotion in somebody that causes them to go and hurt someone. And if we kind of just strip it back to the mechanics again of what's going on in the human body, it is that something's happened, it's triggered an emotion in me, and a result of that, I've then gone and hurt someone. So all those crimes can be lumped in the same thing. To me, I'm going to talk about it in a while, but to me it becomes semantics to think otherwise. It's literally an emotion that we're actually trying to put a label on, but an intense emotion has been triggered by somebody that's caused them to go and kill someone. How I want to feel. And this, I've ended on this for a reason, how I want to feel. So we go to the gym because we want to feel the buzz. If I hurt you because I want to feel power, I want to feel control, sexual gratification, sheer enjoyment, just the buzz of hurting you, that's what I call the pull of emotion. So it's where somebody knows if I commit this act, if I hurt you, it's going to make me feel something. When we're talking about domestic violence murders, it tends to fall under this, because domestic violence is about power and control. It's not about the victim, it's about the suspect. It's about the person committing the act. They're doing it because they know it's going to make them feel something. It's going to make them feel something inside that committing this act is going to trigger. So for me, I wish I'd known this when I was investigating murders, because it would have made solving them a whole lot better. Because if you know what motivates a person to commit crime, it's much easier then to find them. So for instance, if we're talking about a push of emotion, well, if we look for the trigger in somebody's life, that will lead to a killer. If we're looking at benefit, well, what could somebody gain from hurting them? What could they benefit from? Is it financial? Is there some other reason that someone hurting them would gain for them? And pull of emotion too, when you're looking at someone's life and you're building up a picture of their life, is there someone within it that might want to exert power and control over them, or has got a history of that kind of behaviour? So when I had this, it literally was like a light bulb moment. It made every single murder that you could ever come across much more simple to understand. Because if you understand the way a human works and what motivates them, you can understand why they kill. And as I say, once you strip back the legal and the moral ramifications, it simply is someone choosing to do something because of one of those three reasons. And it's serial killers. Now, when we're talking about the pull of emotion, that is what they're doing it for. When you look at the behaviour of a serial killer, when you look at the history of their crimes, it's nothing about the victim. They're not committing it because they hate this kind of victim, or because they feel that this person has wronged them and that person has wronged them. It's all about what's going on inside them. Serial killers act because of an inner drive for themselves to feel that feeling. And when I killed that person the first time, that made me feel good. I need to go and do it again. I need to go and do it again. And that's why you end up with the faces that I've got on here carrying out their crimes, because they keep chasing that same feeling that they had from the first crime. So I'm going to talk about this. That means emotions. I've tried to get an image of emotions and this come up. That's what it means.
Emotions.
So I don't like using words. I can't use images. So emotions. I mentioned this earlier. To me, what happens is what I'm talking about is a very simple theory, essentially. It's very simple. But that shouldn't be simple when you're talking about murder. We're uncomfortable with that, aren't we? If someone's going to take somebody's life, there should be more to it than why somebody would go to the gym. There has to be more to it than that. So what we try and then do, we're trying to understand why people are doing it. So we start labelling it. We start giving that emotion that I'm talking about a name. But it does just then boil down to semantics. We're trying to label an emotion, and I believe you can't do that. I believe even the person experiencing it can't do that. There was a slide, but I took it out. So essentially, I'll give you a scenario. Somebody comes home early from work, and they come in the house, and they can hear something going on upstairs. So they walk upstairs, and they find their partner in bed with someone else. And in a rage, they kill them both. What is that a rage of? Is it jealousy? Is it anger? Is it humiliation? And if you got hold of that person and you took them to the police station and we arrested them and they didn't have a solicitor and went no comment and they were actually speaking to you, and I'm interviewing this person, I said, well, what happened? Well, I come home and I saw my partner in bed and I just got this rage, and I just got a rage of what? Well, what you're then asking them to do is try and label that rage, and in their clumsy way of doing it, they might, oh, I was angry, or I was upset, or... But does it matter? From the outside looking in, well, they were jealous. Well, were they jealous, or were they angry? Or were they humiliated? Well, what's the difference? So, and it all boils down to us being more comfortable to label that emotion rather than just understanding that that's what it is. It's an emotion, it's an intense emotion that caused them to act. And for me, again, once you forget about trying to label it and understand the mechanics and the process of what's going on, you are far closer to understanding the murder than you, the clumsy use of words to try and label it. It can't be that simple. What about if someone's a psychopath, they're suffering from psychopathy? Is that not a reason why someone would kill? Well, no, it's not. People don't kill because they're psychopaths. Is it like 1 in 100? So what would that make? Half of you in this room are a psychopath. That doesn't mean you were then going to go out and kill someone because of it. It doesn't work like that. People don't commit murder because they're a psychopath. If they're a psychopath, they might have a lack of empathy. They might not think about the consequences in the future. Now, if someone's experiencing what I've just talked about, that push of emotion, the pull of emotion, or I really want this thing over here, are they more likely to act, potentially, because of that lack of remorse, because of a lack of feelings? Well, yes. So somebody may be more susceptible to succumbing and acting on those emotions, but that doesn't mean they're going to kill because of them. Nobody kills because they're a psychopath. They kill because it's been triggered. One of these emotions, or the benefit they see, has been triggered. And quite often in psychopaths, it's about that power and control, because that's what drives them. But it wouldn't be on its own why somebody would commit murder. So, what is it that is driving these serial killers? What is it that keeps making them come back? What is it that keeps making them up their game in terms of the violence that they use and the levels of depravity that they go through? Well, there's a simple way of understanding that, and again, it's to think about a human being and what drives them. I was talking about a pull of emotion. So again, if we strip back the fact that it's morally wrong and it's legally wrong that somebody is killing somebody who committed murder, let's compare them to somebody else that would go through this exact same journey. Who would go through the exact same journey as a serial killer? And that would be an adrenaline junkie. The sort of person that would keep chasing that feeling that they want, but has to keep up in their game in order to achieve it. And their journey would be something like this, not strictly, but it'll be something like this. When they're younger, they're on a skateboard and they really enjoy it, and I'm going fast down the street and as I'm shaking, I'm really enjoying it, and I'm getting that buzz. I might fall off, but as they get more used to it and they become more proficient and they've been doing it for a long time, well, that feeling's going to start to wear off. What can I do now? I'll tell you what I'll do, I'll get on a bike and I'll throw myself down the side of a mountain really, really fast, and I'll start to get that feeling. But then that's going to start wearing off too. They're going to start thinking, gee, this isn't good enough. I'll tell you what I'll do, and I'll throw myself out of a plane. 15 times after doing that, well, what do I do now? I can't, I'm jumping out of a plane, I'm not getting the same feeling. I'll tell you what I'll do, I'll put a bit of material on, and I'll jump off the side of a mountain, and that's where I'll get my buzz. That's the journey they go on. No one wakes up one morning and says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take myself to the Grand Canyon, I'm going to put some stupid looking flimsy suit on and jump off into the abyss. People don't do that. This is the journey they go on. And it's the same for serial killers. They don't wake up one morning and, for instance, when we talk about Jack the Ripper, he didn't wake up one morning and say, do you know what, I'm going to go to somewhere similar to 30 Miller Court and inflict those horrendous injuries that he inflicted on Mary Jane Kelly. He didn't wake up one morning and decide to do that. He was on a journey to get there. So, and how does that compare to Jack the Ripper? So, I knew this before I came into looking at his crimes, and I've got to be honest, I completely came into it with open mind. Although obviously doing the research, you do hear other people's opinions and you do hear other people's theories. I tried as much as I could to block that out because I wanted to come at it as if it was a new investigation. As I say, that's what Adeline did. What would I do? I can't do that if I'm just absorbing everybody else's thoughts and theories. But when I came into it, I was really surprised, maybe not shocked, but the path that I've just described was so obvious in the crimes that he was committing. It was like, if I were to write, if I was a fiction writer and I was saying, right, well, I want to get this across. I know this. I know that serial killers go to this path. I'm gonna do this about Jack the Ripper's crimes. And you could not have written it better. You could not have described his journey any closer to that adrenaline junkie than if you tried. And if we look at his crimes. And this is what I want to say as well. Sorry, this is one thing I want to say. Is Jack the Ripper, and no serial killer, is killing for killing's sake. It's not about that. If it was, then we probably wouldn't know about them because they would just commit their crime and go off and disappear. When we're talking about the likes of the Yorkshire Ripper, Jack the Ripper, the killing is a means to an end. It's those acts that they carry out afterwards that is the pull. That is the pull that they're doing. The killing them is just a way of getting there. The killing them is a necessary action for what comes next. If anyone's read my book, I call it the main act. So the main act for these killers isn't the killing. When we look at Dennis Nilsen, his main act wasn't killing those men, it was what he did to their bodies afterwards. Yorkshire Ripper, he was incapacitating his victims with a hammer to the head. He wasn't waking up every morning thinking, right, I need to hit someone with a hammer. He was thinking, I need to go and hit someone with a hammer so I can go and do what it is that I get my buzz from, that adrenaline that I'm getting. So when we're looking at Jack the Ripper's crimes, if we are going to think about what is motivating him, obviously I can't say for sure, I wasn't there, I wasn't in his head, I didn't see the crimes, but for me it was not a push of emotion. It wasn't an angry man who was going out because he got syphilis from a prostitute and he needed to get them back. Clearly from the actions that he was doing afterwards, it wasn't about killing. He wasn't robbing anybody. He didn't have anything. These women were out on the streets. They had no money. He might have taken some things from them as souvenirs, but that wasn't what was motivating. Clearly, when you look at the pattern of his crimes, it was that pull of emotion. And if we frame it in as the adrenaline junkie, we then understand his crimes, and then we can start to see the patterns in what he's doing. So, I'm just going to take it from the canonical five. I know there are 11 in the Whitechapel Murders, but here I'm just going to concentrate on the canonical five. So, Polly Nichols was his first murder. Again, if we ignore the fact that he killed her and concentrate on what he was doing afterwards, that is what he was doing it for. That is what he was doing. He committed multiple incisions, mostly around sort of the torso, and he cuts her throat. So think of him there, he's on a skateboard. This is what I'm doing. But what we also have to have in mind is these crimes do not happen in isolation. He isn't a robot who wakes up one morning and thinks, oh, today would be a good day to go and commit that crime I did the other day, because I think it'd be good. He's living these all the time. He is immersed in his crimes. Every waking hour, he has those crimes on his mind, and he's trying to relive them even when he's not committing the crimes, be it mentally or stimulating himself in some other way. He's living these crimes. This period, if you take it from Pollyanne to Marianne, you're talking about three months. 3 months, intense 3 months of his life where he's living these crimes day in, day out. And when you're doing that and you think yourself you're on that journey, okay, well, I did that to Polly. I did enjoy that, but what would I do next? If I had the time, if I had the chance to do, what would I do next? And then we move on to Tony Chapman, and then you see him, what he's doing next. So yes, he's committing the multiple incisions, and yes, he's cutting the throat, but now what is he doing? I struggle with this word, evisceration. So he's opening Annie up, and I don't know about you, but when I look at this crime, I conjure this image of him almost on it's an exploratory thing. He's opening her up, and he's sort of going through, and he's putting the intestines here, and he's kind of, it's almost like he's on this sort of weird warped journey that he's on, and you can see it in him. He's exploring inside a cavity. And then he takes a part of her. Why would he take a part of her? It's because he's living this. He's living this throughout those 3 months. And as human beings, if you're being driven by emotion, we can try and replicate that emotion in other ways. And by taking a bit of her away, those in between bits, he can then replicate it. It's visceral. He's got the feel of it, the smell of it. Potentially the taste of it. So again, he's reliving it. And now he's not a skateboarder anymore. He's going down the side of the mountain. He's up in his game. He goes off, and then he's thinking, right, so that was good. I really enjoyed that. What can I do next time? Then we get to this one, and this is the one I have a problem with. Anyone who's read my book, I put it out there. I honestly don't think that he killed Elizabeth Strite, and I'm not going to go into the big thing about that now, because that's not what I'm here for. But what I see when I look at his actions from Israel Schwartz is somebody that's being pushed by emotion. He feels more, he's in an emotional state. And what we don't see in all the other crimes is he's in an emotional state, because he's not, because he's seeking the emotion. He's not in the emotional state, he's seeking it. But with Elizabeth Stride, and we see someone who's more acting more, I would say, and again, clumsy words, but anger or some other thing. He doesn't seem the same person. So for me personally, I'm not a fan that this was committed by Jack Ripper. But then we're back on his journey again with Catherine Eddowes. And then we start to see this upping. So he's no longer throwing himself down the side of a mountain. He's now jumping out of a plane. And he's still committing the same similar act. So we get the multiple incisions to the torso, we get the cut throat, we get the evisceration, and we get the removal of body parts. But now he starts to mutilate her face. He's committing acts on her face. He's upping his game. He's doing more. He's seeking that emotion. And he's upping what he's doing to chase that emotion. And just remember, in between these crimes, that's what's on his mind all the time. He's reliving it. He's living it. What can I do next? What can I do next? Probably got a bit more time with Elizabeth Eddowes as well, because he's in that dark corner in Mitre Square, which allows him to do more. But he's on that journey. Now he's thrown himself out of a plane. And then we get the final one. This is his Grand Canyon. And he gets to spend as much time, essentially, as he likes with Marianne Kelly at Miller's Court. And this is where we see it really acting out. This is where I'm in my element now. I'm chasing this emotion. What am I doing? So I'm stripping her skin. I'm upping my game. I'm stripping her skin. I'm removing her breasts. We've seen those photographs, the crime scene photographs. They're horrendous. And it's when he's allowed to have the time and the space, safety, he can really act out chasing this emotion. Really, all those fantasies that he's had in these 3 months, all the things he's thought about, everything that he thinks would be that stimulating me in that way. And if I'm not, what you notice what I'm not doing is I'm not labelling it. Is it power? that he's seeking? Is it control? Is it sexual gratification? Is it enjoyment? I don't think we will ever know. If you get these psychologists, psychiatrists attributing these kinds of words to him, for me they're wrong, because it could be any of them. It could be all of them. It could be none of them. We don't know. But what we do know, if we understand the mechanics of what drives a person, is they're chasing that inner feeling. And by upping the game each time, they're chasing how they felt before, but it's worn off now. I need to up my game to feel that. It's like drug users. That's why someone ends up starting on cannabis and ends up on heroin and God knows what. It's because they're always trying to chase that first buzz. They're having to up their game. And exactly what we see here. We see him on that journey trying to replicate how he felt. I don't believe with Polly Nichols. I think that there's some stuff going on before here. I think he was doing things that ended up at Polly Nichols. I don't think Polly Nichols was a good one. I feel like I've rattled through that much quicker than I would have done normally. So what I do in these sessions is open up to questions. You can ask me questions about anything. All right, anything to do with murder investigation in general, anything to do with Jack the Ripper, etc., I'm happy to answer your questions.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Fantastic talk. Can I ask you, after the murder of Mary Jane Kelly, would you expect a local man to carry on living in the area and not commit any more crimes and feel satisfied? I'm thinking of one or two suspects that keep coming up who may have lived on to the early 20th century, stayed in the same area. Could someone in your experience stop? And have you had any experience of your crimes, you know, be it opportunist or planned, where a killer can stop, but start again, but completely stop?
My answer to that would be, so I have never experienced somebody committing these crimes. I don't think many people have, many detectives. I'd be a liar if I stood here saying to you, I can answer that question with any sort of authority. Now, as a detective, I was an expert on being a police detective. I wasn't an expert on forensics. So if I needed expert input on forensics, I'd go to a forensic scientist. If I needed expert around some kind of intelligence systems, I would go to an intelligence analyst. So if you've read my book, you'll know that in the UK, if we need to understand the psyche of these people and try and get a much better understanding than I can of the kind of people that would be involved and their real behaviours post-murder, during murders, etc., we would go to the National Crime Agency, and they have behavioural investigative advisors, BIAs, criminal profilers essentially. And it would be those that we would go to get their input. And I would lean heavily on Pippa Gregory, who did that for me in the book. And what she says is that it's unlikely that he's only going to stop on his own. It's more likely that something has prevented him to go on and commit those crimes, be it he was imprisoned, he left, he was in hospital, there's something probably more likely is stopping him than him deciding that, oh, I've reached my peak now with Mary Ann Kelly. When you're on that journey, how many adrenaline junkies throw themselves off into the canyon and then they go, do you know what, I'm going to get my slippers and my pipe and I'm going to start reading. They still need that, don't they? So I tend to agree with what she says, in that there must have been something stopping him committing the crimes in that period, if he did stop, than actually himself deciding, I've had enough now.
And yet people do stop. People do stop, like, you know, two years off and then start again.
They do. And this is the difficulty with putting any kind of definitive on it.
There is
no definitive. I lean into hers, it's more likely than no. How can we possibly say he stopped because he chose? Or how can we say he was imprisoned? We can't.
Yeah.
The best we can do is the best guess based on what is most likely. And I think the majority of what we're looking at in these crimes is you can only come in at that level.
Yeah, there's no one, not catch-all, is there?
Yeah.
Hi there, I've really enjoyed the book.
Oh, thank you.
Brilliant presentation. From a modern perspective, a modern investigation, I think Abilene at the time made a decision that the Smith murder and Tabram were not necessarily connected to the murders that then continued on. Would a modern investigation detach those two previous events?
Simple answer is, well, I don't. They didn't detach them in terms of the, they sort of, they lumped them together, didn't they, in terms of the Whitechapel murders. Because there's so little of the paperwork that still exists from the police, I struggle to definitively say what people did and didn't do. From the looks of it, they decided that Emma Smith, definitely not.
Yeah.
Martha Tabram, probably not. But today, we wouldn't do that. What would happen is, quite simply, you would have, once you get to this level of crimes, you would have a number of murder teams working on them under the umbrella of an overall senior investigator. And they would, until you can definitively rule a crime out, they would be investigated as if they were committed by the same person. Because just imagine they were, and at some point you decided they weren't. Well, when you get to court, the defence, through disclosure, will know all your decision-making process. Actually, officer, you back then said they're not connected. How can you now say they're connected? And that, as soon as you do that, you get the doubt in the jury's mind. So what they should have done, I hope we would do now, is that we would keep them together until we can definitively say they were separate. And again, you've read my book, so the way I approached it in terms of what crimes did he commit, I tried to do it as if today, what we would do is we would go to the Crown Prosecution Service with the evidence that could or couldn't link them together. And if, on the basis of the information we had back then, the only way I think we can do that now is by looking at similar fact evidence. And the way I did it was, the fact that they're prostitutes is not similar fact. Prostitutes get killed, they're in a dangerous profession. You can't link two crimes because they're prostitutes. You've got to look for nuances within the crimes that are so unusual that you can, with some confidence, try to link them. And then put it in front of, for me, it would be put in front of the Crown Prosecution Service and then put it in front of the jury for them to make a decision. And when you do that, for me, I think it brings Martha Tabram more likely into the crimes than not. And the injuries that stand out for me, the vaginal injuries, and when you look at the amount of crimes that are committed where vaginal injuries are inflicted, is so rare that when you then factor in the location, the timings, etc., that for me is what more likely brings it in. So I'm saying, this is just my personal opinion, but I believe that Martha Tabram was a Jack the Ripper victim, and I would be comfortable putting that in front of the Crown Prosecution Service saying, if we've charged Joe Blocks over here, I think he should stand trial for them all, and it'd be up for a jury to decide whether or not he's guilty of them all. That would be my standpoint.
Well, slightly concerned that there's half a psychopath in the room. What's your view on the possibility that he would have, you hear this sometimes, cracked up or committed suicide after the Kelly murder? Douglas, in his chapter, I don't know if you're familiar with his book, The Cases That Haunt Us, the FBI employee, he says quite clearly this kind of person would not commit suicide. But it's something you hear again and again. After Mary Jane Kelly, he can't go any further, there's no way out, and the police are all over, and that he might choose to take his own life.
I think, obviously, again, discussing with Cole, there's no definitive answer to that. I think maybe the best thing you can do is look at the serial killers we do know. And, okay, yes, there could have been serial killers that committed their crimes and committed suicide beforehand. But we tend to not have, certainly in this country, series of crimes that are unattributed. You've got, what's his name, Bible John in Glasgow. There aren't many series of crimes that we can definitively link together where we don't identify eventually the suspect. America's different, I'm mental over there, they've got so many murders. but here, if we're gonna look at what can we base anything on? Well, let's look at the behaviour of serial killers in this country and how many of them actually commit suicide. Well, they do, Fred West, Harold Shipman. That's because they got caught and they don't want to spend time in prison. They don't tend to do it before, because what's driving them is that feeling that they're chasing, and it becomes so intense. That's why we don't have many serial killers, because it's really unusual for people to get to that stage. And once you're at that stage, that's what's driving you in life. That's what the time between August and November, that was what was on his mind, that was what was pushing him. My personal thought is that he probably didn't commit suicide, I don't know. but basing it on what we see in the past, but he could have done it, and everything has that caveat. Could he? Did he? That's the difference. Did that answer that?
Likely to crack up?
I think that's a possibility, potentially. He could end up. What I think, so there are various reasons why they didn't solve these crimes. And one of them, I think, is that we now understand, what I've said to you now, I might have put it in my own words and your own spin on it, but I think it's probably accepted most of us understand that what is driving serial killers is that inner desire that they're chasing. And I think the police in 1888 and beyond, what they struggled to understand, they could understand the push of emotion, because we can do that, can't we? We all, on some level, even if we don't agree with the act, we can empathise in some way when someone commits someone because they're angry. That person had come home and found their partner in bed. You can empathise on some level because you can understand the emotion. Even when it comes to the game, you can, on some level, because it's so subjective. So if I were to say to this room, would you kill for £5? I mean, nobody's going to do it. If I said to the room, would you kill for £10 million and no one will ever find out, that half a psychopath would definitely do it, but there might be others that in this room might think, well, actually, potentially, because it's subjective and it's a sliding scale, so you can, again, you can understand in some level why someone would do that. And they really struggled, I think, understanding this pull of emotion. That's why they kept looking for lunatics and were spending so much time looking in lunatic asylums, because, well, who would do that? It'd have to be a madman, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be a normal person. It wouldn't be someone that could blend in and not stand out. But we know differently now, because those faces that are put up are those serial killers. It was only because they got caught that we know them. It wasn't that everybody in the state was saying, well, it's got to be him because he's a lunatic. Because it wasn't. They got caught because of various different things. But then afterwards you're like, well, we wouldn't have guessed. He just seemed like a normal fella. How many times do we hear that? So, and I think that, I can't even remember how I got here. Why did I start? What was the question? Anyway, that is one of the reasons why I think they didn't catch him, because they didn't know who they were looking for. And could he have cracked up? Potentially. But I don't think he started at the point of being a lunatic. I think he could have ended up there, as long as any answer to this could have happened. But I don't think he started off as a lunatic. I think he potentially could have cracked up.
Thank you. Any more questions?
There's a lady at the back there as well afterwards.
The police back then had to rely on their contacts, their informants. They didn't have forensic sites like you have today. What do you see from the modern policing side? Do you rely much more heavily now on all the technology and everything that you, or do you still have to have your hunches, your informants? I mean, how much, you know, they were kind of like the real detectives in a way, because they had to use, everything at their disposal, but they didn't have any real science to help them on the way. So in that sense, for you today to solve a murder has got to be easier, I suppose.
100%, yeah, completely.
100%.
I completely agree. So what did they have open to them then? Essentially, they were really relying on witnesses. And if someone doesn't witness a crime, you haven't got the witness, have you? And then even when you've got witnesses are, when I used to go to a murder trial, the very first stage of the prosecution is you're getting your witnesses in, your members of the public that have seen something, or friends, family, the victim, whatever it is, you're bringing them in. And it's the worst time of a trial. I hated it. It was stressful. Because what you don't know is, well, what is that witness going to say? They made a statement, but quite often they'll come in and they'll change their story. They'll tell you something they didn't put in the statement. But how good was the police officer taking the statement? Did they ask the right questions? And then you've got the highly paid barrister who asked the question that wasn't asked back. You didn't say that in your statement. There wasn't asked there. So you end up in a situation where if you're reliant on witnesses, can be the worst type of evidence you get. And if we look at the witnesses in this case, some of them, so for instance, I can't remember the name now, but the three that came out of the club where Catherine Edo was murdered, what was it that made them, or the one particular man, remember the person he saw with Catherine Eddowes? What was it that, how many people do you pass on the street on any day? And if you were then to ask days later to try and recount that person that, right, you saw someone in the shadow talking to a woman, how much of that are you going to remember? And if we're reliant on that, like they were, it's no wonder really, is it, that we face struggle to solve the crimes. What I would say as well is that I tried not to be overcritical of them in terms of their investigation when it came to things they didn't know. They didn't have fingerprints, weren't around for another 15 years or so. They didn't, obviously didn't have DNA, didn't have CCTV, phones, all this stuff we've got now. Where I did find myself being critical is when they didn't properly use what they tools they did have open to them. So their crime scene management was atrocious at the beginning, but what I liked, what I saw, is they got better as they went through. So for instance, something as simple as house to house. So during the murder of Polly Nichols, they went to the inquest and the coroner asked them about house to house. And he said, what houses have you been to? We looked at a few that overlooked the murder scene. What about the others? Well, if anyone has seen anything, they'll come and tell us. Well, that's just completely wrong, because there'll be many reasons why a member of the public wouldn't approach the police, because they might not appreciate that they saw something important. They might be expecting the police to knock on the door. So there's lots of reasons why that was wrong, and that police officer got chewed out by the coroner. And then what we see in the next murder, when we're looking at Elizabeth Strider, what went on there, is that you had dedicated officers doing house to house with a book that had been set up especially for that purpose. So within the space of one murder, you see that progression. And then by the time you get to Mary Jane Kelly, what you end up with there is the closest resemblance you've got to today. So if I were to go to a murder scene and I was putting in processes, for me, I found it really heartening that that is where they ended up after, what was it, 7 murders, 5 crime scenes. That is where they ended up. And so that progression. I found myself critical in terms of photography, because they didn't use, on the face of it, they didn't use photography until Mary Jane Kelly. But that was nothing new to them. They'd had it for decades. So, and now we understand the importance. We call it the golden hour. If you don't get it right at the very beginning of the crime scene, you're making it very difficult for yourself to solve it. And they made it very difficult for themselves because they didn't deal with the crime scene properly. But in their defence, what, Metropolitan Police have been around for less than 60 years, detectives 40 years, so they were learning. And they were in a position where they'd never come across anything like this.
Well, that's it. Nothing like that.
Exactly. So they'd never come across anything like this, and they were learning on the job. But they did learn, and I found that really heartening. And so for me, yes, we know that they didn't identify Jack the Ripper, didn't catch him, but I am in no doubt that the processes that were put in place during the Whitechapel murders were then implemented on later murders where they would have solved them. So you described it as detective work. I think today we can become quite over-reliant and in a way lazy because we've got CCTV, forensics, phones, all sorts of options open to us that they didn't have back then. So they had to be good at what they do, but it's still generally boiled down to being able to put someone in a courtroom for them to relay what they saw or what they heard. And that's very difficult for witnesses.
Just a straightforward question. What are your thoughts on the Pinching Street torso?
So what I used the same process in terms of similar fact evidence, and I ended up in a position where there is insufficient information to be able to say one way or the other. We don't know who she was. We don't know any circumstances around. Now, if we put ourselves in on this journey with this killer, and we say, well, we didn't stop at Mary Jane Kelly, and there's something, I don't know what it would be, but if you're an adrenaline junkie, there's something else that's more scary than throwing yourself in Grand Canyon, then it could be dismemberment, couldn't it? It could be taking, beheading someone. It does look like it could be a natural progression, but there's not enough information for us to say one way or the other. So for me, my conclusion was, we just don't know.
I just like to a bit more of your thoughts about the journey the person might have been on before the first killing and the likelihood that they would have come to the attention of the police for some reason.
I think unlikely that they would have come to like the attention of the police. Their crimes might have, but not them specifically. Now, you've got to forgive me because I wrote this book a couple of years ago, so I can't remember. Paul Begg in the room is, you know, just my last talk. There was a particular crime, and I wish I had the lady's name over my head. I don't, where she was stabbed on a doorstep.
Martha Tabram.
No, not Martha Tabram. Oh. There was a non-fatal one. I can't remember the lady's name.
Ada Wilson.
It might be Ada Wilson. Yeah. And when you look at Martha Tabram's crime and you look at hers, they're very similar. The way it was carried out. So if that was the same killer, and then it was Martha Tabram, you can see that progression. But we have so little information about the crimes that were going on there. But I think if we were lucky enough to have the CRIS system, so our crime reporting system now, if we had that from 1888 backwards, I've no doubt we would look at some crimes and we'll think, well, actually, when we're thinking about this, I've put his skateboarding at Polly Nichols. Maybe skateboarding was the first crime, or maybe it was Martha, or maybe it was even further back. And if we think about the journey, if it was sexually motivated, and we think about the journey of sex offenders, not always, but sometimes you see that progression. It could be something as minor as stealing knickers off a washing line, or being a peeping Tom to get that thrill. And then they might go on to touching, then more serious sexual assault, then rape, and then murder. And you see that progression. And if he was on that journey, and this was sexually motivated, then we might have all those more minor crimes beforehand that were unreported that could be attributed to him. But everything in this case, it all boils down to the lack of information we have. And it will always come back to coulda, might have.
Okay. Testing. Just a thought on the organisation and the police at the time. The impression I get, could be wrong, is the only ones you can call specialists are Aberline and Swanson. The rest is just ordinary divisional detectives, probably doing everything else as well at the same time. There isn't a specific team as such.
Yeah, and that's not hugely different to today. So if you think about the officers that discovered Polly Nichols, that if that were to happen today, that would be exactly the same. It would be normal police officers who aren't... Basically what they're trained to do is walk away and put tape around it. Yeah. That's the training that we give them. Because beyond that, they would just get in the way. So it's no different. Now, I've got a real problem with the officers above Aberline and Swanson, and I think that they bordered on corrupt, those officers. And so when we're looking at when did Jack the Ripper's murder stop, they were determined that they would stop one way or the other. Even and when we look at the shenanigans around Rose Mylett, when I was looking at that as a murder investigator, I found it shocking. Absolutely shocking that keeps sending back the doctors until you get the answer you need. We call it confirmation bias in the police, and it's basically I form my opinion already, and they had formed the opinion that either rightly because it wasn't, or because we don't want Jack the Ripper to have committed any more crimes, that Rose Mylett was not a murderer. She had accidentally strangled herself. So to keep sending back the doctors until you get your answer. And then when we translate that to Alice McKenzie, and then we look at the Pinchin Street torso, all those crimes, when you look at what was going on up top, it was, essentially for me, it was corruption. I think I steered away from that name, that word in the book,
yeah.
but essentially is, because they're manipulating...
For political or other reasons.
Well, yeah. if you think about it, when Monroe came in, politically, he would have to have made promises to the Home Secretary, and at that time, so if we relate it to today, the early 2010s, it would have been around, we need to save money. So the incoming commissioner had to promise us to save money. Mark Rowley's come in with on the promise that he will sort out the bad behaviour of Met Police. That's his promise. When Monroe come in, his promise would have been, I either catch Jack the Ripper or stop his crimes. And when you see their mental gymnastics and the way they manipulate what was going on in those crimes to fit that, that's what makes me have a real doubt around anything that any of them says from that level up, and I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them.
Okay.
Thanks, great talk, enjoyed that. Have you got any thoughts on those early murders, including Tabram, may actually have been more of a gang than just one killer, like extortion?
Yeah, so, right, so obviously you can only go by the information you have. And when I look at the murders of these types of serial killers, they're my words, I'm not an academic, so I'm not taking them from anybody else. I call it the incapacitation and the main act. So they neutralisation and the main act. So the neutralisation we see here is more likely the cutting of the throat. So the cutting of the throat makes them in a state that he can then do his main act on. For the Yorkshire Ripper, that was a hammer across the back of the head. His crimes itself changed slightly, but it was always his neutralisation was the same. If we take the information that we've got on Martha Tabram, and if it was two knives, and it was the dagger to the heart, and if we are going to relate it to this kind of crime, then that to me looks like that could be the neutralisation. And if that is, that's somebody taking a knife there with, this one is for a specific purpose, to incapacitate her, to neutralise her, and the smaller one is for me to carry out. And it's, if we're chasing that feeling, it's that's what's really giving me this buzz. It's that plunging the knife in. And if that is the case, then it fits more that it's more someone that's, if we're thinking about the three different sort of motives, a gang would be for benefit. What would be the benefit to a gang? Robbery? For me, it's, those injuries go way beyond robbery. If we're talking about someone using neutralisation, then that almost rules it out. And again, I'll come back to the injuries to the vagina, which are so rare that for me, more likely to make it a pull of emotion act than the push of emotion or a gate. Does that answer that? Yeah. No? Have you forgotten? Oh, you didn't think that for. Well, I've not answered it.
Yeah, Emma Smith said it was a gang.
Emma Smith, and I've talked about Martha Tabram. I don't think Emma Smith has got anything to do with Jack the Ripper. I think it's just the fact that she was a sex worker who got killed in Whitechapel, that she got pulled into it. And if we take her words, as you say, then it was two or three people with a spotty 19-year-old, whatever he was, then that was more likely a gang. And it is a dangerous profession being... So these are times where people are desperate for money, and there's a female on her own, just walking away potentially from a client with money, she's immediately a target. And they were gangs that would go, I don't have to tell you, you know this better than me, what was going on back in 88. Yeah, I'm talking about room experts there. But back then, there were people roaming the streets looking to rob these kinds of women. So for me, I'm just going to have nothing to do with that, but more likely a gang.
She was penetrated with an object.
Yeah, but they're very different.
There was a sexual element to her attack. So I think what a lot of people might be drawing on with the question is that is there a possibility that an individual involved in that attack could be connected to the later attacks?
Again, possibly, yeah. Could that have been the trigger? Could it have been that I was with them and I like that and I want to do that?
The adrenaline.
There is no definitive, yeah. Is there? And is it a possibility? Yes. Is it likely? Personally, I think no. I think if you were to say on a scale of, I always use this sort of scale of like, am I sure? Do I believe? Do I not know? In terms of that, don't know for sure, but I couldn't get to any kind of level where I was satisfied to say that, yeah, I think Emma Smith in any way is related to Martha Tabram, is related to anything that came on.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was excellent. We now have a break.
We have a break.
Good day.
We just have a break, yeah. We're back at 2:00 with Alistair.
Oh, we go drinking any time.
And that was Stephen Keough with What Was Jack the Ripper's Motive? We are a podcast sponsored and hosted by casebook.org, where you will find hundreds of roundtable discussions author interviews, conference presentations, review shows, and so much more. All about Jack the Ripper, true crime, and Victorian history. If you have any questions or comments about the show, drop me a line at rippercastpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.